Good evening and welcome to this evening's Yeshiva University Libraries Book Talk. We're pleased to have Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Shiffman with us this evening to discuss his book, Psyched for Torah, Cultivating Character and Well-Being Through the Weekly Parsha. Rabbi Shiffman is a YU alumnus in Musmach, and he received his PhD in psychology at St. John's University. Currently, he's an assistant professor at the Azrieli Graduate School, as well as an assistant rabbi at Kingsway Jewish Center in Brooklyn and licensed psychologist. We are happy to welcome Rabbi Shiffman to discuss his work and whatever else with us this evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tina and Shalamis. Thank you for inviting me. I just posted the PowerPoint in the chat, but I will share my screen as well. So my book is called Psyched for Torah, and what I want to do with you this evening is give you a little glimpse into the book, but more broadly speaking, give you an idea into the methodology of how to find psychological insights and themes within Jewish texts, particularly the Parsha, but as we'll see at the end, this can be done with other texts as well. So by the end, I don't know if you will be able to call yourself a psychologist if you are not, but I do want you to be able to do some of the things that I have done in this book, and you'll see how I went about it. So to start off with, just to give you a little bit of a definition of psychology, and here's where we're going to show that I believe everyone has the potential to find psychology within Torah texts. And that is, if you see here, definition can be broadly distinguished between three different components here. And the one that's most important for us tonight is psychology is defined as the study of the mind and behavior. The mind is somewhat complex, but we can simplify it as incorporating our thoughts and our emotions. And if that's the case, what psychology is the study of our thoughts, emotions, and behavior. So if that's the case, anytime we can identify thoughts, emotions, or behavior within a Torah text, we are engaging within psychology. That might not be the discipline of psychology, the academic research of psychology, but it is psychology in the sense that psychology is the study of thoughts, emotions, and behavior. So if we can go through the Torah and look for wherever thoughts, emotions, or behaviors can be identified or uncovered, then we are at least on an unprofessional level, but on an interest and theoretical level, engaging in the study of psychology. Two more components, which we'll get back to perhaps at the end of the talk, is that in the blue now in the definition, historically, psychology was an area within philosophy and emerged from it. And what that's telling us is that even though psychology as a modern discipline began in the middle to late 19th century, it has a larger, broader history that has its roots in study of philosophy dating all the way back to ancient Greek literature, but as well as throughout the Middle Ages, that the study of philosophy included ideas which we would now incorporate under psychology. So that opens up the potential for us to explore within medieval works such as the Rambam and others, the idea of how psychology historically was understood throughout the ages. It's a potential way of engaging in this study of psychology and Torah. And then the third part, the green part, and this is the more professionally academic part of it, it is now a diverse scientific discipline comprising several major branches of research, including experimental, biological, cognitive, lifespan, developmental, personality, social, all classes that you can take at Yeshiva University if you're majoring in psychology, as well as several sub-areas of research and applied psychology, including clinical, industrial, organizational psychology, school and educational, human factors, health, neuropsychology, cross-cultural, et cetera. So psychology as a discipline has many components to it, but my argument is that will enhance our understanding, and what I do in the book is use research and ideas from these components of and subcomponents of psychology as a discipline. But that's, and if you are a psychologist, then for sure you can use those tools to understand Torah texts, but that's not what we're going to do tonight. We're not going to look at it as from a professional standpoint. We're going to look at it from a more thoughts, emotions, behavior, which I think is an activity that everyone can engage in because we all have components. We all know what thinking is. We all know what emotions are. We all know what behaviors are because we all do it. So we can engage the text from a thought, emotion, and behavior. Again, in the book, I add on the actual academic disciplines that I think enhance our understanding of the Torah text even more. We'll save that for a different book talk. So here are three strategies that I encourage all of us that we can engage in when we're studying Torah text with an eye towards psychology. Number one is to be sensitive to the words and the stories that have psychological connotations. And in a moment, we'll delve a little bit deeper into that. And I'm going to ask you for your opinions and guesses in the chat. You could type it in to me. What words perhaps should get us excited and think about? That word should open up the door for us to think in terms of thoughts, emotions, and behaviors. What Torah concepts can we fit in there? And number two, we'll see this as well shortly in an example from the book, from different parshios, that we can read the classical Mefarshim. Once we have a lead in terms of the words that should highlight for us, that should put our radars, our antennas should go off. Once we have those words, we can look in the classical Mefarshim with an eye for psychological insight and nuances, because the Mefarshim had these insights. They didn't have the discipline of psychology, but they were attuned to thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, and had a tremendous amount of insight within with understanding human psychology. And then finally, the third thing we can engage in to understand psychology within the Parsha and text in general is to look for psychologically oriented modern commentaries. There are commentaries that focus and have a, even if they're not an academic discipline of psychology, but are psychologically bent. They have great insights in psychology. So what I would like to do with you this evening is to go through some examples of this, show you how we can engage in this, and then point you towards the book where I write these up and combine them with the discipline of the academic discipline of psychology for further insights. The main goal of, and there's a running theme within the book, as the subtitle of the book is called, bringing you back to the first slide here, character, cultivating character and well-being through the weekly Parsha. So we're using psychology and Torah text as a lens to enhance our lives, to help others, and to connect with God, so we will have a better chance at flourishing. So there's a goal for why we're using the psychology and combining it with the Torah. And here we go. So in the chat, if you can type into me, can you think of either words or concepts, ideas to look for as you're reading the Torah? What words pop into your head that we should be looking into? You can send it directly to me. I don't think you can send to everybody, but if you send it to me, I will get it. Okay, we got some are coming in here. Generosity, sensitivity is a good one. Anger, that's also a good one. Jealousy, fear, brotherhood, stiff neck, am kishei oref, as it's called. Love, reconciliation. So we already have a lot of great concepts and ideas and words to look for. Masa avo simon levanim, what the ancestor did serve as a precedent for the later generations. That could be a good insight. Pity, sibling rivalry for sure. Conflict. So we have a lot of different ideas already from the crowd here, just brainstorming where these things come up in the Torah, and we can keep our eyes out for them when they come up. We can now delve a little bit deeper into them, try to analyze them, look for what the commentaries have to say. And then later we can see if there's any real psychological research on it. But again, that comes later. So, okay, last one in here is projection, which is a more in-depth psychological insight that comes up a lot in Rabbi Abraham J. Tversky's commentaries. Perhaps we'll get to that a little bit later. Okay, now I'm closing the chat. So if you chat now, I might not see it, but let's see some examples of how this plays out. So we have here, or I'm gonna choose for you three words that I think are psychologically loaded that we should be looking for that will help us again, gain clues into psychological insights into the Torah. The first one, and this is taken from the translations here, and the graphic comes from alhatorah.org. They have a concordance, which tells you all the times the word comes up in the Bible. So this is pretty fascinating. The word nefesh, literally translated here as soul, living being, life, self, person, desire, appetite, emotion. As you can see, it's used in many different possible contexts, all with a psychological bent towards it. It sometimes means desire, abhorrence, loathing, sorrow, distress, joy, love, alienation, hatred, revenge, and passion. It's a large spectrum of psychological concepts that this one word can use. And what that does for us is that when we see the word nefesh, we should already, our antenna should be going up. What is the psychological insight? What is the pasuk? What does the verse want to teach me here? And here's the clue, is that because there are so many possible definitions, it's going to be our job to think within the context, what does it mean here? Because it can mean any of these things, depending on the context. And again, we'll see some examples of this with a different word shortly, but it's also, this graphic's fascinating. You can see how it's spread out. The word comes up many times throughout the Tanakh, the Bible, a lot in Bereshit, some in Shemot, a lot in Vayikra, the Midbar, Dvarim, these are the five books of Moses, comes up a bunch. In the prophets, it comes up. And then, as you can see, in Psalms, in Tehillim, and in Mishlei, Proverbs, it comes up a lot as well. And Eov, these are, to some extent, these three, Tehillim, Mishlei, and Eov, are psychologically minded texts, which will be important to look at later on. But for our purposes, for the book's purposes, you can see Nefesh comes a lot in the first five books of the Torah. Another example, Lev. Lev can mean inner man, mind, will, heart. You see here on the left-hand side, 10 different possible ways the word lave, heart, comes within the Bible. So what's interesting just off the bat is that lave, when we hear the word lave, sometimes we associate it with heart. And when we mean heart, we associate it just exclusively with emotion. That's not true within Tanakh. When the word lave is used, it can mean any of these 10 different possible things, which aren't necessarily emotion. So it can mean the inner man, mind, number three, knowledge, thinking, reflection, memory. These are very psychologically loaded words. It can mean inclinations, will, resolutions and determinations of the will, conscience, moral character, the man himself, seat of the appetites, seat of emotions and passions. So sometimes you have lave with joy and gladness, lave with trouble, sorrow, pain, vexation, and trembling. That's pretty, again, you have, it could be in context, can mean the opposite thing from joy versus sorrow, depending on where you are in the verse. And it could also mean courage. There's a lot of different possible explanations. So you see the word lave, our antenna should be going up. This is a word that has psychological connotations that I should be thinking deeply about, that maybe there's an insight here that if I just read too quickly, I'll pass over. And again, you have the graphic of when lave comes up, the similar spread, although it does come up less in the first five books of the Torah, except for Bereshit and Shemot has a decent spread of it. The prophets have a decent spread as well. And just like in the other word, the first word, you have a heavy dose in Tehillim, Psalms, Mishlei, Proverbs, and Eov, these three in the middle towards the right. Finally, last word we'll do as an example is ruach. Ruach, translated here as breath, wind, and spirit, can mean up to six main types of ideas. It can mean wind, breath, life, spirit force, physical strength, a mental state, or an emotion. So it could be associated with being depressed, down, unsettled, angry, impatient. It could be the will to commit to something, or it can mean wisdom. A nice, interesting spread it here as well. A little bit less, even though still a lot in the Tehillim, Mishlei, Eo category. A little bit more in the first prophets, Nevi'im, Rishonim, Yeshayahu, Yechezkel, Isaiah and Ezekiel. So what we have here is, I think, and you could do this with many other words, but I think these are three really big important psychological words. When you see it, to think about it, what's the meaning? What is it trying to tell us about thoughts, emotions, and behaviors? To bring this out in a little bit more practical sense, we're going to take this word ruach and see how it applies to a verse. And this is was eventually developed, these ideas were eventually developed into an essay in the book. The essay is in Parshat Va'era, and it's entitled Deep Breath. And here the verse in Exodus says, this is when after Moses is told to, by God, that he should tell the Jewish people that they're going to be let go, that they're going to be free. And as a consequence of that, he told the Jewish people, they got somewhat hopeful, and then the work got harder. So Moshe is trying to give them these messages of hope and redemption, and instead they aren't receptive to it. And here's how the verse expresses it. By the Ber Moshe Kain of Bnei Israel, he spoke these words of redemption to the Jewish people. Velo Shamu El Moshe, they would not listen to him. Mikotzer Ruach Ume Avodah Kasha. Okay, so right there, we have the word that I told you want to be on the lookout for. This ruach is there. Mikotzer ruach, they translate it here as anguish of spirit. We could debate whether or not that's a great translation or not. But kotzer means a shortness, right? I would translate it probably a little bit better. Mikotzer ruach is the shortness of ruach. Perhaps they translate it spirit. Maybe it means breath. Maybe it means emotion. We're not sure. Because remember, ruach can mean all of these possible things. Right? So maybe it's not enough wind, not enough breath, not enough life, not enough spirit force, not enough physical strength, right? Or maybe they were depressed. Maybe they were angry. And so it could possibly mean all of these things. And now what's fascinating is that the commentaries, as we're going to see, this was step two. I told you to look out for the words, hypothesize what it could possibly mean in this context, and then look at the commentaries, because the commentaries are usually going to pick up on the nuances and give you different possible explanations. So you have here shortness of, which is translated as shortness of breath, and hard work. So what we want to figure out is, what does this mean? And how is shortness of breath differ from hard work? So here we have a few commentaries. It's in Hebrew, but I will translate everything. Rashi, the famous commentary, says, what does it mean, shortness of breath, mikotzer ruach? Kol mishehu meitzar, anybody who is in pain, rucho v'nishimato kitzara. Their breath and their spirit and their breath, nishima is actually the breathing, is short. They have shortness of breath. The eino yachol l'harich v'nishimato, and they can't take long, deep, relaxing breaths because they're maybe anxious, and maybe they're having a panic attack. Maybe they're, right, when we have quick, short breaths, maybe we start hyperventilating. It's very difficult in those moments to take long, deep breaths. So Rashi is already giving us some clues in terms of some psychological insights. And here, the Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, is a commentary, it's a super commentary on Rashi. So Rashi is a commentary on the Torah, and the Maharal is a commentary on Rashi. So he elaborates and says that if you pay careful attention, it says two things. There's shortness of breath, and then there's hard work. So he says those are two separate things. V'yira lomar, ki shnei dvarim heim shelo shamu. There are two reasons why they weren't able to be receptive to the message. Ha'echad, the first is mikotzer ruach. So how does he translate the kotzer ruach here? Shehayu do'agim al hamalacha shehem tzrichim la'asot. They were anxious. They were worried. So he's adding an element here that Rashi didn't say explicitly. He's saying that the emotion that they felt, that mikotzer ruach here means that they were anxious because they had so much work to do. Maybe we can empathize with such an experience, at least to some extent. V'chol mishehu mechashev al davar kasha. Anybody who thinks about a difficult task that they have to do, who do'eg umatzirlo, it worries them, it causes them pain, suffering. And as a consequence, v'nishmato kitzara, they have this shortness of breath. So that's reason number one. But the other reason is v'gam otziba acheret is me'avodah kasha, the hard work. Shayu chalashim, they were weak. V'lo yihayad da'atam yushevet aleihem, they weren't able to basically have peace of mind or comfort. So Rashi's, Maharal within Rashi is explaining that there's two different elements. The reason why they weren't able to listen to is they were physically exhausted from the hard work. That's element number one. But it's more than that, because it was psychologically distressing. They were anxious. It was too much to do. They couldn't handle it. So they were unreceptive. And again, this is what anxiety does to us. Anxiety makes us shut down and not being able to be to learn or be receptive to messages of hope. It usually keeps us confined and constricted in our thought processes. And as the physiological manifestation of that is shortness of breath. Before we try to figure out how to fix this, let's look at two more quick sources. As we've mentioned, ruach can mean many different things. So we've had pain, suffering, anxiety. We have a similar manifestation in the Ramban, Nachmanides, source number three. Bikotzer ruach, he says, hu pachdam, fear. Now, fear and anxiety aren't exactly the same thing. And here the fear is manifested not in terms of the work they had to do, but shelo yahargein paro becheret. They were afraid for their lives. It was a physical, mortal danger that they felt fear for, that paro might have killed them. So here you have another, this is what I'm trying to show you. The commentaries take this word, which is vague to some extent and can mean many different things, and you start having a spread of different options of psychological insights into what was happening in the minds of the Jewish people while they were in Egypt based on this verse. You have anxiety, you have fear, and then interestingly, number four is me'avodah kasha, the psikta zutarta, which is a type of homiletical medrash on the Chumash, on the Bible. It says, milamed shehaka'as misaliket hadat. So kas is anger. So he's saying that anger, what were they? Weren't they? Maybe they were anxious, maybe they were afraid. But this source argues that they're actually angry. Why were they angry? Maybe they were angry because Moshe told them that they were going to be free and now they have to work harder. Maybe they were angry that they were slaves. Maybe they were angry at a lot of different things. So here you have a third emotional possibility within the commentaries, that perhaps they weren't anxious or afraid, they were angry. So here the same word, the ruach, is a clue. Our antennas go up. And then we want to think through, what could the Jews have possibly been going through? What would it feel like? What would I feel like in such a situation? And maybe I'd be anxious. Maybe I'd be afraid. Maybe I'd be angry. Maybe I'd be hopeless. And there are more commentaries, just for the sake of time. I didn't quote all of them. I do quote them in my essay on deep breaths in Psych the Torah. But you have other possibilities here. And by us having our antennas up, thinking, what is thoughts, emotions, behaviors in this situation? What would it be like? How can I relate to this? Look in the commentaries, which give us a language that we might not have seen on our own. And now we have a wonderful insight into what the Jewish people might have been feeling at that time. They were anxious, they were afraid, they were angry, maybe a little bit of everything. They were hopeless. They were unable to receive the message of hope from Moshe. Where the insight now can come full circle is by following psychological therapeutic techniques. What are you supposed to do when you're anxious and you're short of breath? So you have to learn how to take deep breaths, right? That's a big part of the intervention. Yes, there are ways we want to think differently, but physiologically, we need to learn how to increase our breathing techniques to the point where we can take what's called diaphragmatic breathing, belly breathing, where we can change our short breaths to being longer and more physiologically resetting our negative emotions to the fact that now we could be receptive to other people. We could listen. We could pay attention. We could be productive because the deep breaths are counteracting the shortness of breath. And again, I refer you to the Psych the Torah on Parsha Va'era to read a little bit more about that, but I think this illustrates the first part of our methodology, which is look for the word, and then second part of the methodology, look for the commentaries and see the span of ideas that they bring out. Let's look for another example here, and this brings us to this week's Torah portion, Parsha by Yishlah, And I guess anxiety is in the air. So this one's also about anxiety. And the verse says, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayetzer Lo. Yaakov, Jacob, before he was confronting his brother Esav, he was afraid and he was distressed. So therefore, he split his children into different camps, and he split the animals into different camps, and he strategically started figuring out how to deal with this eventual confrontation with his brother Esav. What the comment is, so here we have two words, that psychologically oriented words that our antennas should be going up with. One is fear, by yira, it's an explicit emotion word, so emotions should be on our radar. And then by yetzer, similar to how the last example Rashi used the word yetzer, distress. These are two emotion words that are going to point us to a psychological insight. And what's interesting here is that what the commentaries are going to be bothered by is the seeming redundancy. To the extent that fear, we have to distinguish between fear and vayetzer, and distress. There's two emotions going on here. So sort of like buy one, get one free in terms of psychological insight, because it's not just one thing that's happening here, it's two things that are happening here. So the commentaries are going to offer us a lot of different possibilities here. And if you wanted to, even before you get to the commentaries, use your own thinking to figure out, hypothesize, what could it be? What's the difference between this fear and this distress? What could possibly be going through Yaakov's mind that leads him to feel these emotions? What is he thinking? And how is that impacting how he's behaving? So a lot of possibilities here, even before we get to the commentaries. But fast forwarding a little bit to the commentaries, here's just a small excerpt from some of them. Here you have on the top Rashi with the Hebrew and the English. It says, by yira, that fear, that's one emotion, is shema yeharig. Maybe he might be killed. That's the fear. So what's the distress? By yetzer lo, he was distressed, im yaharuhu es acher, because he didn't want to end up killing somebody else. So Esav's attacking, he's going to attack him, so maybe he'll be killed. That's why he's afraid. He's distressed at the prospect of having to kill his brother or his army. So that's why there's two emotions, according to Rashi, the fear and the distress. The second source here is Bachor Shur, another commentary on the Torah. He says, similarly, we have to find two emotions here. It says, Ki lo yada ma la'asot. Why was he stressed out? Why was he anxious? Why was he afraid? Because he didn't know what to do. Right? Put yourself in Yaakov's shoes for a second. His brother's coming at him. He knows that. But he doesn't know what his brother's mindset is. So if his brother's coming to kill him, then that's one way of preparing, right? So Shema Yodela Shekama Tola Ra'a, if he knew he was coming to do bad to him, he could have ran away. He could have protected himself. He could have fought back. But maybe Esav is coming to honor him, to greet him, to say hello, reunion. So then if that's the case, then he's in a bind, because in Yivrach, Yasim lo lev, v'yir lo derech sina. Then if he runs away, if Esau's coming to greet him for a reunion with good intention, but Yaakov runs away, then that's going to look like a hostile move of hatred. K'moshe omer b'nei adam, im yesh mishi yivrach harbe, yiyah mishi yirdof, v'im kavatol ra'ah, im yachol amod, k'neged arba me'ot ish. So he's in a bind. Do I stay? Maybe he's going to kill me. I'll be killed against 400 people. Or do I run? Then it's going to look like I'm angry at him, and maybe that's going to lead to its own set of issues. So lefika hayametzer shlo hayyodeya mayasa. He was upset. He was distressed because he didn't know what to do. And for those who know a little bit about anxiety, this is a huge source of a lot of anxiety. Is the unknown. I don't know what to do. If things were clear, even if they were bad, at least I'll be able to deal with it. I'll be able to prepare. But when I don't know, is it going to be good? Is it going to be bad? How to prepare? What's going to happen? And all the what ifs that come along leads to additional psychological distress. So that's according to the Bachor Shur. Fascinating, fascinating insight. Now, one more, also powerful, is the Das Sakanim, another medieval commentary on the Torah. So he says, "Vayetzer lo, meitzer haya." Why was he distressed? Al shaya yare me esav, La'achar she'hivticho HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was upset at himself because God promised that he would be protected, but he still felt afraid. So God promised me I'm going to be okay, Yaakov saying to himself, but I still feel afraid. So by Yira Yaakov, he's afraid. By Yetzer Lo, he's distressed at the fact that he's afraid because he had a guarantee. But his response, his psychological response, maybe it was out of his control. He was still afraid. How can I be afraid if God told me I'm going to be okay? And this, again, is what we would call a secondary emotion over and above the initial emotion, right? Sometimes we have a distressing emotion like fear, and then we get upset at ourselves for having that, right? I'm angry at myself for feeling that, right? Not only am I depressed, but I'm angry at the fact that I'm feeling depressed, right? Why am I feeling, I shouldn't feel depressed. That according to Das Kanem is what's going on. That's why there's two languages here. He was afraid, and then he was distressed over the fact that he was afraid. Tremendous psychological insights by looking into these commentaries. And the bringing it all home with the second example is the Abarbanel, a late medieval commentary, where he points out, I think this is very powerful and important for our own dealing with distressful emotions. He says, Pachad Yaakov v'yirato me'esav, the fear that Yaakov had from Esav, lo haya michul shat emunato. It wasn't because he didn't believe in God, ubitchuno biyudav, or God's promise. Ki be'emet libo batuach b'Hashem. He fully believed that God was going to protect him. Aval haya pachto kederach hagibur ha'amiti. This was real fear because courageous actions. And if you read a little bit further on, he's quoting Hafilo Saf Pesefer Amigos, Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, that courage is not the lack of fear. Courage is acting despite the fear. So what Abarbanel is saying, step number one, is that Yaakov had full belief in God, but he was afraid. How is he afraid if he had belief? Well, being courageous doesn't mean that I'm not afraid. It's a now. But why was he afraid if he fully believed it? So watch this, Abarbanel, second paragraph. Hine imkein pachad Yaakov haya mehechrech hachomer. His fear was from it was hechrech. It was against his control. It was from the chomer. It's from his physicality. It was physiological. The fear ubitchono haya mafat sichlo. His trust in God was intellectual. So what the Abarbanel here is saying is that his trust was fully intellectual. And that's okay, that's what we want. But there's a psychological component, a physiological component to fear, that even if you know you're gonna be okay, sometimes you still feel anxious, right? So, a little personal self-disclosure for a second here, right? I'm pretty confident that I'd be able to give this presentation. I know my book, I know what I wanna do. I'm not rationally nervous, but physiologically, my body is telling me to be nervous, right? There's a little bit of that in the background. Even though rationally I'm okay, physiologically, there's a little bit of nervous. That's what the Abarbanel is saying is happening to Yaakov. Rationally, he had trust in Hashem. Physiologically, there's nothing he could do about it. His body knew, mihechar hachomer. The physical reality was his body was telling him he's afraid, be a little bit anxious. Now, and he brings a great example here. At the end, he says, we find this with, I'll just paraphrase in the English, we find this with somebody who's sick and they have to take some level of medicine. And you know, I guess back then, the medicines, Michel Schell, it was going to cause him some problems. The medicine would heal him, but give him some bodily harm along the way. So it was going to save him, but cause some damage. So he knows that he should do it, and he knows that it's important. But still, his body's going to get nervous before he gets that. Or when you go to get an injection, you're getting a vaccination, a shot, whatever. You know it's good. You know you're supposed to do it, but you still get a little bit afraid beforehand. Because it's sometimes there's just a physiological reality to the fear and the anxiety. He says that's what's happening to Yaakov. Yaakov was confident in God, believed in the promise, but there's a physical reality of the anxiety and the fear as it manifests. And now what's important bringing this home is that according to Abarbanel, and again, I elaborate on this in my Psych for Torah on this week's Parsha, Healthy Anxiety, is that this anxiety is okay for Yaakov to have, and it doesn't get in the way of what he needs to do, which is prepare for all the possible scenarios that might come up, which is exactly what he does. Where anxiety becomes unhealthy is where it paralyzes us and leads us to not act because we're just too nervous and we avoid. There's nothing wrong with feeling a healthy anxiety. That's natural, Abarbanel is saying. That's physiological. As long as you have the rational trust in God and you then go act appropriately by preparing yourself for the possible outcomes, and Yaakov serves as that paradigm. So that's example number two. We saw Kotzer Ruach Avodah Kasha, the Jews' shortness of breath, counteract that with deep breaths, and we see healthy anxiety within Yaakov. Do one more example, and then we'll bring this to a close. Case study three, a second example in Parsha Vayishlach, and here is, this is this week's Torah portion, here we have a what I would call my third methodological point from before. If you remember in the beginning, I said there are three things to look out. Be sensitive to words and stories that have psychological connotations. So we've seen that. We've seen words to look out for. Then read the Mefarshim with an eye towards psychological insight. We did that. We saw that with our two examples. And here, the third suggestion is to read psychologically oriented modern commentaries, because often, even if they don't use psychological language, they will give us insights that we can then expand into the psychological realm. So two of those types of modern, commentaries that have psychological insights, even though they don't use psychology as a discipline, we'll see in a moment. It's based on this other verse here. We're told after Yaakov fights Esav that he goes and has a battle with an angel. And the way that it's described is that Yaakov leaves his family and is confronted by this angel or this person, unclear exactly what's going on, and they have this battle until dawn. The way that's presented in the verse is Vayivater Yaakov Levado. Jacob was left alone, Levado. So we're going to see now two totally opposite insights from this word, psychologically oriented insights, that teach us two truths that I would argue need to be balanced out. And that is, the first one, it comes from Rav Yerucham Lubavitz, the Das Torah. This is a Musar work on, it's a ethical teachings related to the weekly Torah portion from a very psychologically minded person from the early 20th century. And we're not going to read all of this inside. I will explain it to you outside. And again, you can read this. I wrote this up for this, for Insight to Torah for this week's Torah portion. What Rav Yerucham Lubavitz argues is that the concept here of Yaakov being left levado, alone, is that it connects, this word levado, alone, relates to a verse that we know about God, where it's told in Isaiah, the Niskav Hashem levado. God will be exalted levado, alone, by himself. And so there's a connection between God's aloneness and Yaakov's aloneness. So what's the, and it seems to be something positive. What's the message? Why is there a connection between, what's the value of aloneness? So what Yerucham Lubavitz develops here is that levado, from a godly perspective, from a divine perspective, is that God can do, is basically self-sufficient. Right, can do anything on his own. Doesn't need us. Right? He can do anything on his own. Can take care of the world on his own, and it's completely alone in a good way, in the sense that he can be self-sufficient, and that is what Yerucham Lubavitch says we're being taught about Yaakov at this point. Yaakov is levado, meaning he's finally got to the point where he can be self-sufficient. He can take care of himself. He can fight for himself. And that's going to help him move forward in terms of creating a new nation moving forward. So the levado here is teaching us the psychological importance of self-sufficiency. In the psychological literature, you'll find this in different terminology, whether it's in, you can read the Psych for Torah, you'll see a little bit more about this, internal locus of control, which means I can take control of my life. I can do things on my own. Things aren't forced upon me. I have a sense of agency. sometimes called self-efficacy. A lot of different terms for this, but the importance of being able to be self-sufficient is the value that we learn from Yaakov's Levado. On the flip is the Nesivos Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe, who has a little bit blurry here. I apologize, I'm not sure why that is, but he has the exact opposite insight. And he says that the only reason Yaakov was put in danger that he ended up having to fight this angel is because he was Levado. He was by himself. The second he separated himself from his family, he was put into danger. And the Slonim Rebbe's argument here is that the value of togetherness, of community, of being part of a group, and both of these are tremendously important psychological insights that are both, they're opposite, but both true, right? It's important for us to feel connected to others. It's important for us to have relationships where we can rely on others and we can be there for others. And it's also important for us to be, to try to be self-sufficient, to be able to take care of ourselves, not to overly rely on others. So from the same word, from the same story, from the same Levado, we have two opposite psychologically minded insights from two modern commentaries who aren't quoting to you psychological studies, but what they're doing is they're finding, because psychology is mind, behavior, and emotion, they can pull out from the stories what the messages we can have about how we can be psychologically, what we can learn psychologically from the stories in Chumash. Just to sort of sum up and show you some future directions, and I'm happy to take any questions that people might have, this sort of a summary of what I do in Psych for Torah. In Psych for Torah, I go through over 100 different essays on the Parsha, around on the weekly Torah portion, around two per week. And there are they're all different. They all have different insights from commentaries, from words in the verses, like we've been doing today. Plus, I add the modern psychology from the discipline side, the academic side of it, the research, the theories, and the people that you would confront and deal with within the discipline of psychology. There's a lot of insights there in terms of, again, how to cultivate character and well-being, that we can combine the Torah and psychology to get there. What I'm working on now for future projects, and I'm pointing this out for anybody who's interested in this to either follow, or if you're able to interested in collaborating or discussing or learning with me, I'm happy to spread out and meet new people and learn new things. One thing we're doing now is Psyched for Avos. So I'm taking the similar methodology related to the Parsha and putting it to Pirkei Avos, ethics of the sages. And you can subscribe. It's a weekly email I send out. You can subscribe to that at psychfortorah.com. We're working on trying to integrate that into schools as well. I'm working on another book, Psyched for Tshuva, dealing with concepts of repentance, topics that we teach about here at Azrieli and other courses at YU relate to positive psychology, happiness, well-being, how that relates to Torah. And then finally, in more of areas of academic interest, I am interested, going back to what I brought out before, is that there is a whole discipline related to studying psychology in previous generations and how there's a history of emotions and a history of philosophy and psychology. And if we can study that from a Jewish studies perspective, perhaps we can gain even more insight, understand the Chazal better, understand the Rishonim better, to see where the psychology was during their time and how that perhaps impacted and gives a better, deeper understanding of them. So these are a few of the things that we're working on. Feel free to keep in touch. I'm here to answer any questions. I guess you can put them into the chat. I think Shalanis is going to
moderate them.
moderate. Thank you for the word.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to jump in, feel free to, because you can see it just as well as I can. Somebody directed it to me. It says, I know some people are uncomfortable with reducing the actions of our Gedolim to a human level. How would you answer that?
Okay, it's a great question. In part of I did have a slide that I took off for the sake of time, but there's a great article by my friend, Dr. Zev Elif, who Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif, on whether or not we can psychoanalyze biblical figures. And I would stay away from that. I think that in terms of trying to put too much of ourselves and you know, getting back to the word from before, projecting what everything we feel onto the sages and bringing them down to our level is not what we're supposed to be doing. And the patriarchs that we're supposed to revere and respect them and realize that they aren't us and we're not them. Yet, I also believe that there are things that we can learn, especially if it's explicit in verses and based on commentaries. So what I at least did in this book was that I limited, I tried to, I believe, I guess you could catch me on this if you find some difference, but I limited any insight that I would have from psychology about whether it's, you know, Moses or, you know, or Abraham, you know, Moshe, Avram, any of the patriarchs, to something that was found in a source, something that's found in the commentaries, because then I felt more comfortable saying it. But I wouldn't just throw out, you know, diagnoses and, you know, issues and saying they struggle with this. And even talking with conflict and sibling rivalry, I would be careful and use our sources and commentaries to guide that discussion. That's my personal approach for that. It's a good question.
And there is another question. Does each biblical figure represent a certain archetype? Example, Joseph as a favorite son?
Maybe. I mean, I'll tell you what also you're not gonna find too much of in this book. This is partially just because of my orientation, both to Torah and you know, perhaps more to psychology as well. I don't do a lot of, this might be jargon for some of you, I'm happy to delve more into it if you're interested, but I don't do too much analysis from a what's called a psychodynamic perspective. So I don't talk too much about Freud. Archetypes is usually associated with Carl Jung. I don't really deal with that. It's not my background in psychology. There are some books you can find that talk more about that. I'm just because I don't have, it's not my expertise, and I don't fully connect with that approach. I don't try to do that. So perhaps there are other people who might be able to better answer that question. So I'll sidestep it for now in terms of what archetypes you can call. I'm not holding in the archetype literature.
Okay. I have a question. I'm just wondering if our forefathers or the matriarchs or anybody was self-aware, like were they emotionally intelligent? Is there a way for us to know that?
Again, I don't know exactly if we can answer that conclusively in terms of using our terminology. This is part of where that history of emotions comes into play, and we're using, you know, modern ideas to put onto an older text that doesn't necessarily know what those ideas are. But I would say just stick with the sources, right? So look for the ideas in the text, look for the emotions described in the text. And that's really what we're working with. So if you have those, if you have the emotions, if you know what it says, if you know that it says that Avram, you know, or Yaakov was afraid, then presumably we know that Yaakov was afraid. What that meant, again, my argument in that essay was that you can put the sources together to make the argument that he was very emotionally intelligent because he knew he was anxious, but he was able to put it into perspective and still act appropriately in that scenario to prepare for the battle with or the confrontation with Esau, right? So I think you can make that argument, and I would, you know, my guess is the patriarchs, for the most part, you know, in the sources in Tanakh, they are aware of emotions. You have people who fail. Maybe they're not their heroes. Maybe they're the villains of some stories. But you have people who fail in terms of their emotions. You know, there's definitely a decent amount of sibling rivalry and conflict that needs to be dealt with. I don't fully deal with that. There are some books that deal with that. I tried to, again, part of what the book sort of subtitle is about is it is to focus more on the constructive, positive ways of looking at things, and not to denigrate or put down, both for theological reasons, but also for practical reasons. Let's look for inspiration to try to grow.
I don't have any more questions on my end. Do you have any on yours?
Yes. I have a few different things here. Okay, one is just to point out that in ancient times, there were disorders weren't known by these disorders. This is part of the different talk for a different time. Actually, Professor Ari Mermelstein, who did a book talk last year, speaks about the history of emotions in his book, in terms of how psychology and emotions were different in different time periods. So there's a comment here about just pointing out that the categories and disorders and names both were different in terms of what they were called, but also to some extent there's some things that are totally culturally mediated, meaning that they're dependent upon a time period. And there are other things that are more universal and ahistorical that apply to all time periods. So you always want to be careful in terms of transposing ideas from current times to past times, in terms of figuring out exactly how that works is a challenge. A good comment to keep that in mind. The other comment is, are there any commentaries that discuss Jacob's parenting skills? So yes, I think Shimshon Rafael Hirsch famously commented in terms of how, and was critical of the, not of Jacob, of Yitzhak, for treating Yaakov and Esau the same when he should have parented them, Chanuch Lenara Pidarko, to each child, their own path. So you do have some commentaries that are critical of some parenting. In terms of Jacob's parenting explicitly, it could be, and nothing pops into my mind this second. Again, my approach generally will be, if we're going to be critical, at the very least, we got to find somebody greater than us who said it. So you have a homework assignment to go see if you can find it. There is a book that discusses the family dynamics from a psychological and biblical perspective out there. I forgot exactly what it's called. Maybe it's Climbing Jacob's Ladder. I forgot exactly. You could check it up. Okay.
Somebody get back to Dr. Shippen on that.
Yeah. Okay. A few more different things coming here. Okay. So this is somebody pointed out that Shaul HaMelech was there are articles that diagnose biblical figures, and I would just be cautious of doing that. I think it's not just for, again, not just for theological perspectives of, is it the right thing to critique or criticize, but just from a psychological perspective, that the whole idea of psychohistory and psychobiography is fraught with tension. It's very hard to diagnose people from reading a text. It's very hard, unless you're there are criteria of diagnosticians of how they diagnose. I would be careful of putting any labels on people just from reading a text. Somebody pointed out that the Nesiva Shalom might talk about the concept of Yaakov's parenting skills. So that's a lead if anybody wants. Somebody else asked, should we always start with Rashi as far as psychological insight? Is he a springboard, so to speak? Not necessarily. I don't think so. It could be he does, but not necessarily. You could go to other commentaries, which actually reminds me of something I wanted to mention, which is, if you're looking for psychological commentaries on the Parsha, besides for Sefer Torah, I highly recommend Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch Weinreb has a book called The Person in the Parsha. He's a rabbi and a psychologist who has psychological insights from put out a great big thick book on that. Rabbi Abraham J. Tursky has Tursky on the Parsha, very highly recommended. Rabbi Zohar Pliskin has Growth Through the Parsha. He's a social worker with a lot of great insights into the Parsha and many, many other books as well. And then Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, like I wasn't a psychologist, his commentaries, his essays have a lot of psychological insight. So those are all great Parsha psychology books that deal explicitly with psychology. The other commentaries that I spoke about aren't dealing with psychology. They're dealing with psychological concepts like thought, emotion, behavior, but not the discipline. Those commentaries that I just mentioned talk about the discipline specifically. Okay. So yeah, so follow up on the Nesiva Shalom there. That apparently, again, this is, I don't remember reading this, maybe I read it a while ago, but apparently he talks, reading the comments, talks about that Yaakov was focused on Esav's good, that this would be Yitzhak, not Yaakov. Yitzhak was focused on Esav's good quality, his love for mitzvah, kibbut of aim. Okay, so that's, and you can check out the Nesiva Shalom on that parenting. Next question, are there overarching themes about how to contend with emotions like anxiety that we can learn from the Torah? It depends what you mean by overarching themes. I don't think that there's, it could be if you spin a lot of insights together, you can have something. I wouldn't say it's necessarily from the Torah. It could be our reading of the Torah. I was able to look in and find, to some extent, what I was looking to find in the sources, which was ideas that lined up with psychological theory in terms of taking deep breaths. So that physiological reaction, that second essay we spoke about, in terms of trying to keep it functional, and even if you're anxious, prepare, do what you have to do. That was the second insight. Both, I don't know if those are overarching themes, but those are two really important ideas. Off the top of my head, are there other themes related to anxiety? I do talk about healthy and unhealthy emotions and how to deal with emotions, not necessarily anxiety per se, but when Yosef was overcome with emotions when he met his brothers, it says that he went into the other room and he basically washed his face. And that itself is another strategy to use to regulate emotions, the label of that essay was called freezing emotions or something along those lines, where from dialectical behavior therapy, the idea is when you're emotionally dysregulated, to reset your emotions, your physiological state, to put your face in cold water for a few seconds, that'll sort of hit the reset button. There are themes that come through. If you have this insight, you look for where the emotions are in the Torah, you can start picking out for what strategies you might be able to use. Okay, I don't have any more questions coming in this way. So
it's about almost 9 o'clock. This was fascinating. I love psychology. I love Torah. So it looks, just from the faces on the screen, everybody was really into this. And I'm going to follow up with an email, just to remind you about the code to buy the book, or any book from Kodesh Press, actually. There's 25% off. And I'm putting it in the chat right now, winter 2022. If you have any questions, follow-up questions, please feel free to email me. If you have questions for Rabbi Dr. Schiffman, you can forward them to me, or I don't know if you feel comfortable, if you want to give back your email.
My email is right there, mordechai.schiffman@yu.edu. Again, you can check out psychedfortorah.com if you like these types of Torah insights. The website has lots of them. You can find some of the stuff in the book on the website. You can find the new series on Pirkei Avos. Once a week it comes out. It's also featured in the Jewish Press, but you can get it directly to your inbox if you subscribe. I do not spam or send anything else besides for that once a week email, so you don't have to worry about that. No solicitations, just some psychology and Torah delivered to your inbox every week.
Okay, thank you very much. And everybody, thank you for coming out. Even though you don't have to physically go to a place, it's still hard to get this into the schedule. So I appreciate you attending. And our next book talk is on December 14th with Rabbi Chaim Jachter and Binyamin Jachter, his son. They co-authored a book, A Gaddic Mindset. So stay tuned for that flyer. That's going to be coming shortly. And have a great night. So long.